So today, some of you have ventured to Amaravati to face this mighty topic called Is Hope an Illusion? If I said yes, that would be the end of it. Could go home, couldn't we? But in a way, life, just like words, just like life, which is always tend to complicate things, words always require some kind of more complicated answer or, let's say, relationship than an empty mind. You could say words, concept, ideas, and so on. And it's an interesting topic for me because, of course, as a Buddhist nun, from the very beginning of my practice, our Vipassana practice, understanding of the mind, understanding of the content of your mind, we call it Dhamma Vipassana, content of the mind, the experience of the mind, and so on. From the very beginning, everything you are kind of encouraged to investigate those Dhammas in the light of the three characteristics of Anicca, Dukkha, and Anatta. So is hope sort of different from everything else? And this is why the reason it's interesting is because after a while, after you practice for a little while, for a few years, the tendency to kind of turn everything into Anicca Dukkha Anatta before you even experienced it is quite strong in all of us, isn't it? Have you noticed? You know, somebody bothers you and it's just Anicca, you know. Somebody is difficult, you know, or there's nobody there really. You know, the Buddha said there's nobody there, so that should be all right. That should deal with my problem. Don't have to go to the psychotherapist for the next 2 weeks, you know. That should be okay. You know, or suffering. Oh, well, if Joe is suffering, it's make me suffer. As the Buddha said, suffering is, you know, life is suffering. So we tend to kind of stick all these kind of conceptual realities, you know, onto reality. If you follow me. And use the Buddhist teaching as it's a good patch-up, isn't it? So instead of being with reality, we tend to kind of glue some kind of Buddhist concept on it, preferably the one that sort of, helps us at the time. So if you really enjoy something you're totally attached to, you know, word dukkha is just not going to come up, is it? But if somebody really annoys you, then you're going to immediately think dukkha. When you want something to be very permanent, long, you know, lasting forever, wonderful, you know, the Buddhist teaching just not so interesting at that moment. You know, the three characteristics of existence just kind of seem to disappear in the background to, you know, make room for, you know, I wish it will be Nietzsche, Sukha, and Atta, if I prefer, and I could control it and keep it forever and ever, as if we could control life. Can we? Any finger up? Can we? Can we control life? So hope, you know, after a few years, I remember, I mean, I should confide a little story about this hope thing because I ended up, it's not, the way titles are chosen at Amaravati, I'll give you a little secret. We are given a blank sheet of paper, a pen, and anybody in the community can actually write the title they would like to see talked about during the summer. It's very consensual here, democratic. And then Achin Sumedho chooses one, you know, and as he said jokingly, anyway, I'll talk about the same thing every time, you know. Kind of teasefully. But what was interesting is that not long ago, somebody, some very dignified gentleman asked me, who'd been in Thailand many times, asked me if I had a specialty. Like, you know, in Thailand, you can be specialized in the Abhidhamma or Vipassana or Jhana or some kind of, you know. So after deep pondering, you know, going deep down into sort of as empty as, you know, as deep into emptiness as I could get, I got a surprise and I said to him, well, I do have a specialty, yes. And he looked very sort of perplexed and curious. You know, said, yes, it's called actually conscious hopelessness. That's it, isn't it? And I was not joking at all. You know, it's like when you realize, every time you attach to something, you're hoping for this to give you something, don't you? I mean, you wouldn't be attached to something if it was not going to give you a good deal, would you? Would you? Would you be attached to your suffering if you're not getting something out of it? I mean, we're quite materialistically minded, aren't we? Would you be attached to somebody if she were or he was not going to give you something in return? If you had nothing to gain from that person at any levels, would you? So there is some hope, isn't it? There is an expectation. There is a waiting, wanting and a waiting for something that you like. Of course, so when I say conscious hopelessness, it means when you are attached to hope, or let's say hope is something you believe in, what happens is that the process of this seemingly benign attachment takes you straight into the pit of hopelessness, if you're not careful. Disappointment, despair. And, you know, words are quite powerful. Because at some level, most of us, when we believe in words, we actually create the reality of those words. You know, the more, let's say, you know, the more you feel somebody should be, you know, if you have, let's say, an idea about how people should be, life should be, peaceful, calm, quiet, kind, loving, caring, patient, sweet, preferably sensitive, and noticing my needs. Important, isn't it? Somebody noticed my needs. Now, what happens is you get sort of, you're left after a while. It might sort of work for a little while, but after a while you might just left with this horrible feeling that nobody cares. Everybody is really upset and annoying and irritating and uncaring and all that sort of thing. Because that expectation, that hope, you know, that something that you hope to see manifest into your life suddenly might not. It might, but it might not. So hope is a difficult concept in a Buddhist, for any Buddhist practitioner, mostly because we are part of a culture which is a Christian culture in which hope, you know, is part of the three sort of cardinal virtues, isn't it? Hope, faith, and charity. And I remember myself not being brought up as a Christian, but noticing that I like this word hope after spending 15, 17 years or 16 years maybe on Anicca Dukkhanatta, just letting go of things, you know, as you know, just keep on, you know, as you practice, you keep on seeing those, everything that arises in your mind as a reality of these things, which is basically what the Buddha teaches, you know. You can see very clearly that against a peaceful, unentangled, detached mind, you know, any attachment is painful. Any desire to hold on to anything is painful. Any desire to see things as permanent is painful. Any desire to see things as me and mine is painful. You know, so those three characteristics are very real when you look at consciousness, you know. In contrast to a mind that is relaxed, at ease, I say detached, but not in sort of kind of cold-hearted way. Just not expecting anything. Just being at, you know, being in contact with life as it is. And so, in contrast to this, then you have these three characteristics, which are basic reality of our deluded mind. You know, when the mind is in a, don't see things very clearly, when the mind sees things in a kind of illusory way, then what happens is that we start creating all kinds of things, and we set the ball rolling, and we set the world rolling, and we said our universe is several universes, many universes rolling. You know, and that's kind of, we're quite addicted to that, let's face it. You know, we just love setting things in motion, don't we? Giving birth to things, you know. We just love that, you know. I mean, I know from my own experience, I could just watch myself, my sense of self, you know. Somebody explains something to me and we go from A to B to C to D, E and F, and immediately my energy will start rising up. I've got a project. Fantastic, I've got a project, you know, this idea, I've got a project. Oh, all about praxis and Ibana. Oh, that's so great. I know how to do it, I know where to go and go for it, you know. Of course, you know, a few hours later, you're back with the humdrum of consciousness, you know, and you're back to the norm kind of thing, the norm of delusion, which means, you know, there's a whole kind of, you know, a whole array of characters in there, you know, a whole array of situations and problems and difficulties and so on. And so we are back into the normal sort of mindset, you know, the ordinary habits mind. So I remember coming to this, you know, at a point in my practice where I felt, but some words, of course, you know, I was investigating, you know, as you investigate the mind, you realize some words are very unpleasant and other words are very pleasant, you know, like hope. Oh, I'm still hopeful. Ah, it's Anicca Dukkha Anatta, shut up. You know, it's like, you know, you're not a Buddhist if you believe in hope. You know, but hope, some words are very pleasant, aren't they? Hope, aspiration, love, metta, peace. You know, kindness, generosity, all these things, all these words, unless you are, you know, strange. All these words, even sort of the most rotten person, you say to this person, you are very lovable and I love you just the way you are. Even the worst person will probably respond. And so, me, at least they will say, no, not me. You know, so the Buddhist teaching is, you know, is a kind of manual, you could say, of the mind. It's a manual. It'll tell you everything you need to know to get a sense of urgency. That's all it does. Buddhist teaching, all it does is a good manual to keep you on track and to scare you stiff, you know, about being deluded. You know. I mean, in a compassionate way, when I say scare you stiff, is that you realize suddenly the sense of urgency is really, you are really kind of something in you, sort of, oh my God, I better get going. You know, death may come tomorrow. That's what I mean by scare you stiff, you know. Oh my God, I might lose my loved ones tomorrow. I might not be with my favorite things tomorrow. And I'm worrying to death about, you know, what happened when I lose that thing. But it might be gone tomorrow. Somebody might steal it. Something might happen to that thing. If it is a human being, they might be run over by a bus or died suddenly of a heart attack or who knows. If it is a thing, it might be just be burnt or stolen or lost, losing your favorite iPods. Oh! How could you do living without your favorite digital gadget? Besides the fact that they are expensive, one agree to that. So, you know, our practice, in my practice, let's say, I've learned to that nothing, you know, no matter how strong my aspiration can be, no matter how strong this word, you know, wanting something to happen, no matter how strong that is, you know, unless I believe in the gods, some kind of Christian god or some kind of, anyways, any kind of gods. But even to believe in God and to follow the way of God, I'm sure you've got to work quite hard, you know, isn't it? Is there not a saying, you know, If you go on a journey, just, you know, pray to God, but tie up your camels. It's a nice relationship in a way. You've got also to do a bit of work, you know. So hope, you know, expecting our hope to manifest is a great delusion, isn't it? Because it takes a lot of work to make something happen. And it takes a work which is, you know, both ways. It's a work of setting up the right causes for things to happen and at the same time doing what is necessary to not expect anything from life, except what happens, you know. So a process of detachment as well as a process of aspiration. So this is a path of practice, in other words. So you can set up like intention are very important in a Buddhist teaching. Intention, you know, not under the name of hope particularly, but you set an intention. So that's more real in some ways. Even thought is still anicca dukkha anatta. It's still, even that intention needs to be nurtured. It's like a garden, you know, you can't plant, you plant your little cabbage, but if you don't water them regularly and if you don't sort of make sure that the sun shines on them occasionally, nothing will grow. You know, and if you talk to them not nicely, then there's, you know, they might start to grow slower. I'm sure that even cabbage have got their own temper. Sometimes you would imagine like flowers, you know, have their own little moods and feel things. And we have had proof since then that, you know, the vegetal realm do feel things. I can tell you a little story about a plant that I had, for which I had a lot of hope, huge amount of hope, in fact. It's like a mother, you know, a mother hoping that their children, or the father, are going to, they hope their children will fulfill all their unfulfilled desires, you know. Even my mother, when I became a nun, she said, "Oh, so nice, I wanted to be a nun myself." Who knows? I mean, maybe I'm just a nun because my mother couldn't do it, you know. Her hope got fulfilled in me, you know. So, you see what happens when you're not mindful. Anyway, this plant, it's actually a good example. I didn't think I would bring it today, but it's a good example. It's a very sweet thing, you know, it's about a plant. And having been a dancer before myself, I'm quite attached to form and beauty and so on, you know, and colors and so on. So I had seen the same. Somebody offered me a busy lizzie. And I always liked that flower, not especially now, by the way. Don't bring me busy lizzie for the next 2 years. No, I'm fine. Don't need any flowers now. But this busy lizzie was given to me, and I had seen other busy lizzies, so they had a way of comparing, unfortunately. And the busy lizzie I had seen before were so much more pretty than mine. And it's so much more kind of fulfilled feeling, a sense of fulfillment in those flowers, which I couldn't see in mine. I kept this flower for 2 to 3 years, and one thing that happened, it didn't have the sort of kind of branches that go up like that in a sort of hopefulness. You know, it's like hope is always something that goes up to heaven somehow, towards God and the divine, you know, not something that droops. Well, mine drooped for a long, long time. So every time I looked at it, I had to practice intense mindfulness not to droop with it. Disappointment, you know, I went through the despair and disappointment by this plant. Just like a mother with a little baby that just doesn't behave the way they do. They should, according to their expectations, you know. And so one day after, you know, I developed quite a relationship with this plant. I'm sure she knew all about it, that she was disappointing me. But anyway, I'm sure she talked to me at some point, because I looked at it one day and I said, enough is enough. I know what I had done. I forgot the main part of it is wanting it to kind of go up. I had put a little stick underneath a branch. You see, I had been really forceful to that plant. I had my agenda, and I couldn't let it go. And so for 2 years, it had a little stick under it, and it grew fairly, you know, looking the path kind of thing. as if it was sort of had this elegant sort of shape going up to the heaven. And then one day I looked at it and I said, enough is enough. We're going to take the stick out. That's it. And it went like this. And I said, it's all right. You can just be the, you know, I was practicing, you know, being at peace with the way things are and so on. You know, so I used it as my object of meditation. I said, it's fine. You can be just the way you are. I love you just the way you are. It's okay. No problem. I don't expect anything anymore. And lo and behold, within a week, yeah, you know what happened? The little branches started going up again, just like this. I couldn't believe my eyes. You know, I thought, this is amazing. What a teaching this plant is giving me, you know. Just let go of everything and things happen just the way you want, you know. That's itself a teaching in itself, isn't it? Just let go. And I have had this lesson so many times. Just become completely consciously hopeless about everything. And everything turned out well. In my experience, in my own experience, I'm not saying in your experience, but in my own experience, things turn out much better than anything I had hoped for or expected. What a relief, isn't it? We don't have to do anything. But we do have to keep our eyes open and be aware. You know, so this awareness is really the central, the sort of nutshell of our life. It's like the core of our life, because it is only when we're in touch with this mindfulness, awareness, wakefulness, awakening mind, the awakened mind, the whatever it is that takes you back to the moment, into the here and now, which is really this sense of awakened presence, which is a word which I resisted with Ajahn Sumedho for a long time, because being a disciple, you know, you have resistance with teachers and teachings and so on. Even the best one, you know, you just, no, it's my way, you know, instead of stomp your foot. And I don't want to use one of his words. I want to use my words, you know. But finally enough, you know, after forgetting about all this, suddenly I started using the word awakened presence, you know, and that was my own word almost. So yeah, that's exactly what it feels like, an awakened presence. And so that's really what is important, you know. Hope, just like metta, just like a kind word, you know, may I be at peace, may I be, you know, is a kind word, and it brings kind vibrations in the mind body, and it generates kind things around us, and you attract kind people. So, you know, it's a whole world arises just out of one kind thought. So, you know, but interestingly enough, as I was kind of looking into the topic and noticed those, I wasn't brought up as a Christian myself, but I do have a terrific, enormous kind of, a sense of quite a great love for the Christian teaching somehow, you know. And the teaching of Christ, and they're always interested to hear what those Christian teachings are. And one thing is that, you know, hope become a virtue only when it's related to the divine, you know, when you are really hoping, opening yourself to the, let's say, the blessing, the gift of God, you know, what the Christian call God. Well, for us, we don't talk about God, but certainly when we are mindful and aware, we bring into the present moment, for one thing, a quality where wisdom and compassion can be tapped into. And also, we can allow our karma to come and, you know, to release our karma, to release the history of this me and mine world. Because liberation, the path of liberation, is about, you know, letting go of your attachment to the manifestation of the mind, of a manifestation of greed, of hatred and delusion, which is a vast topic, you know. But basically, the Buddha was very compassionate in sort of, summarizing all this as letting go of suffering. You know, he didn't say you mustn't be greedy, or you mustn't be this, or you mustn't be that. He said, observe the suffering that come from this particular mind states. Notice. and not with a judgment. It's, you know, you it's like you don't have to fit a model. The Buddha, the teaching of the Buddha is marvelous because of this, because you don't have to fit anything. You just have to notice, where is your suffering? Where do you suffer? Maybe you recognize right now, I don't suffer at all. Maybe I just don't need Buddhism right now, because I don't suffer. So the Buddha doesn't want you to be converted to Buddhism. He say, if you happen to suffer one day, well, the teaching is here. That's what I have. These are my insights. These are my knowledge. These are my understandings. Try them out if you wish to. You know. So you don't have to become a Buddhist. Even hope to be a Buddhist. Even hope. The worst hope is to become a. Is to hope to be a good Buddhist. That's really the worst of all. That's the worst, because all you're going to meet, I mean, to be a good Buddhist, you have to be courageous enough to meet everything that's really not very good in oneself. You know, to be a good Buddhist, you have to observe your delusion. Is that good? I haven't found it particularly pleasant myself. The only thing that is pleasant is that this quality of wakefulness, because it's freedom right there, right here and now. You're free. You're not stuck onto those states of greed, hatred, and delusion. That's a great gift of the teaching and the Buddha's insights. But you can only see it when you are in that awakened quality of awakened presence here and now. So it does take quite a bit of work. And the Buddha was also a very practical teacher, which means he didn't expect things to happen by just praying, because that's just the way things happen. Again, remember, tying up your camels. Sure, that's quite tough to tie up your camels. I mean, if you've got 10 camels with you, first of all, you have to feed them so they actually can walk, to keep them going before you even tie them up. But you know, this relationship between how much we need to do and how much we need to be also in a place of surrender in oneself, being able to face the mystery, the unknown, the not knowing mind, the mind that desires to know, and you keep telling the mind, I don't know. Because we don't know. That's reality. We don't know, do we? Do we? If you think you know, ask yourself, who is it? What is it that knows? What is it that makes you believe that you can know what's going to happen next? It's only a memory, isn't it? It's only what you imagine it to be, what you hope for, what you expect, what you want, what you wish for, that's all. But hope is an illusion in the sense that we never know what's going to happen next. You may walk out of this door enlightened. Then they say within 7 days you have to ordain if you're an arahant. Wow, that would be quite something, wouldn't it? You know, at some level we hope, we all hope for the peace and the, you know, the truth and the teaching of the Buddha. But imagine yourself turning into an arahant and having to ordain in 7 days. Whew. That would be a tough deal, wouldn't it? You might actually say, well, I'm not sure. Maybe I should go backward a bit. Go backward, you know, back to my sort of normal sort of daily life. So, you know, there is a very famous teaching which explains how by just practicing the path of Sila, Samadhi, Panya, you know, the Noble Eightfold Path, anything that a monk or a nun wishes in relationship, in connection with their path of awakening, with their journey of awakening, anything they wishes, if they're really diligently cultivate the path of sila, samadhipanya, ethic, virtue, samadhi, the ability to calm the mind and to see through insight the reality of our mind and body and the world, you know, and then understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding the suffering, I mean, seeing, you know, letting go of suffering, seeing suffering, knowing the cause of suffering, letting go of suffering, and then walking the path that leads you out of suffering. Then if you do that, he said, you don't need to wish for anything, because basically, you know, if you want anything to happen in your life as far as your path of practice is concerned, then all you have to do is to cultivate diligently those three aspects of your life. And whatever you wish for will happen. Even in the story in the Buddha's teachings of a couple who they wanted to meet each other again after they die. And they came to the Buddha and said, you know, we want to meet each other again. And he said, well, you will be able to meet again, but you have to have absolute pure virtuous life. Interesting, yeah? So, going back to what do we do with this capacity to hope and anticipate things, you know? From the point of view of practice, we're not, it's not a mistake to anticipate things, you know, like maybe you anticipate certain danger, you know, or you anticipate certain joy, but as long as you know that reality is dependent on so many factors and so many causes, how can you know what's going to happen in the future? I've seen many people who are quite psychic in, you know, in their ability, and you know, the wise one know very well that you don't know what can happen in the future, because the conditions are so, a lot of meditators you find, you know, among them, you know, one or two, you know, maybe one person every so often who has this ability to see past life and certain things that can happen on the at an invisible level, and or at least invisible for us. But most of them will tell you that they can't tell, you know, what's going to happen next. Even Ajahn Tate, Lumpo Tate, who was one of the most famous forest masters, you know, meditation master in Thailand. Even when all the psychics of Thailand were on his case to tell him how long he was going to live, they said only maybe very short time. And he himself, through his meditation practice, checked out all the elements in his body and realized that he was going to live another 10 years, and he did. You know, and he was about 80, I think, already. You know, all the psychic of Thailand, you know, being really interested, because he's one of the most, you know, famous monk in Thailand. He passed away now. So, you know, maybe everybody's hope worked, you know. They hoped he would last longer. But they didn't, maybe, you, as long as you know that things may turn up, you know, hope it can be such a source of suffering, because it's not reality. You know, I hope all my sisters here will live with me to be always kind and loving with me. I'd hoped at some point. And even when you know better than that, you know, rationally there's a little story there that's, yeah, I hope so, and it's going to happen. Even if a part of yourself know very well nothing can happen the way you think it's going to happen, and if you expect it, I mean, this is your... you are in for a great disappointment. That's why I kept talking with humor, in a way, this sense of conscious hopelessness, because for me, it has a very humorous connotation, you know. It's a bit like the story of the very great sage at the top of the mountain who is finally visited by this young guy from California who is looking for the guru. He's looking for a guru, and he's been looking for a guru everywhere. Finally climbs the mountain after a huge amount of effort, comes to the top of the mountain, find a big guru with long beard, white beard, you know, looking very sagely up on the top in full lotus. And the young man says, what is the secret of, you know, liberation or truth or something like that, you know? And the great sage, you know, the cartoon says, well, peace, discipline, restraint, and simplicity. Discipline, restraint, and simplicity. So the guy kind of looks up at him. He's been already bowing several times before, and great sort of. He said, well, is there anybody else I could talk to? You know, so you can imagine, you know, how, in a way, you can see your heart. I mean, there's an aspiration in oneself that is looking for the truth, looking for liberation, searching, you know, really aspiring to something more noble and more real and more free than our kind of conditioned reality that keeps turning around like a hamster spinning on a wheel. You know, and so we always go back to the same thing. I see it in myself. You know, we have a little object, we go back. Go to this one, and then at 5 o'clock we go to that one, and at 6 o'clock we go to this one, and at 8 o'clock we go to that one, and every day, certain days of the week we do this, and certain day of the month we do that, and certain day of the year we, you know, so we have a kind of, you know, very kind of routine, conditioned sort of momentum in our mind. That just keep going to the same place. We don't actually challenge ourselves a lot. The thing that, you know, as from the perspective of the path of freedom, you know, what do we challenge? Do you know how we challenge ourselves? By constantly creating problems. But without realizing, we because we think that I am creating this problem, then you compound the problems and there's no challenge whatsoever. You keep compounding the walls of your prison, you know, you keep sort of thickening them up by not realizing that, you know, reality is much more powerful than any of your thoughts, any of your problems, any of your hopes and, this, you know, and hopelessness. Reality is much bigger than that. You know, if, when your mind is quiet and still, when your mind is relaxed and at ease, when you stop searching, stop looking, stop anticipating, stop hoping, stop desiring anything, see what happens to your mind. It's quite amazing. Most of our habits is to think that if I did this, you know, the scenario is, if I do this, then I might feel dead. I might not exist. True, I might not exist. But is existence dependent on I, what I think, what I feel? What I think I should feel, what I think I should think, what I'm programmed to think? See if you can live without a program, without hope. Really worth experimenting, you know. To think that if I don't think, nothing will happen. Isn't it giving a lot of power to your thinking? I hope I can quote this beautiful sentence from a French writer called Balzac. Some of you may know him. Anybody? Okay. Last sentence of a quote, he says, I'm probably paraphrasing it, you know, I'm not going to quote it ad verbatim, but basically, what a suffering to anticipate misery It's like giving suffering and misery the place of the unknown, when the unknown is actually the infinity of the soul, he says. The unknown is the infinite. The soul's infinite. And we understand, I mean, of course, Buddhists don't talk about souls. Terrible. Bad mark, you fail your exams. But we could, you know, we don't need to compare it, but intuitively we know what it means. The mind, you know, the heart. When the Buddha talks about the unborn, unoriginated, unformed, you know, this immensity that can be experienced when we stop seeking, searching, looking, doing. You know. So why do we have to turn the unknown as a suffering reality? When we do this, we are caught in hope. Because if we don't hope, if we don't want to suffer, then we start hoping for something better. And then we depend on that expectation. And then that set the ball rolling again. You know, we hope we don't get old, we don't get sick, we don't get, you know, whatever. Or if it's not us, we hope that our children don't get old, don't get sick, don't get... You know, if you look at the list of hopes that you have, well, I hope by the time you get out of this room, you just kind of tick them off, all of them, and start living anew. Start on the blank page, which is reality. Reality is a blank page. Nothing there. How much do you want to write on it before it starts? You know, you don't need to start it. It's there. It's here now. Right now. How much are we going to write? And I hope for this, and I hope for that. I hope to be enlightened. And I hope to be free one day. And I hope my mother will understand me and my husband will start behaving properly. I hope my auntie this and my grandmother that and my cat this and my... And I hope the monks and nuns will stop doing this and that or will do more of this and that. Hope. It's a long list, isn't it? I hope my life will turn out the way I want. Oh my God. That's a bingo one, isn't it? Bing! The feeling. How many of us have worn on this one? Eh? I never wanted to be a nun particularly myself. I stopped listening to my thought for one moment and look what happened. It's all it took, you know, not much. Even... So, be careful. It's a dangerous path. And some of you miss on the joy of life because you're so kind of stuck on your, you know, on the agenda of hope. Oh, you know, that's a kind of fairly positive agenda, but there's also the agenda of despair, isn't it? Sort of, you know, how many things I'm despairing about right now. My job, my partner, my dog, my children, my carpet, my house, my window, my landscape outside my window, the job is a big one. I think I got out easy because, in a way, I was a dancer before, and you know, I thought if I'm going to live in this life, I'm just going to do what I want to do. I'm not going to have a job. I'll have something I enjoy doing. So I was a dancer for about 12 years, and then after that, I started practicing Buddhism and didn't stop kind of believing my thought for a few months, and No, nothing that intended to do happened. I don't regret it. I think it's the most wonderful path, but, you know. So, just to show you the miracle of life, you don't know what's going to happen if you, you know, lose your mind in a good way. I mean, not become crazy, but lose the illusion of having an agenda. It's so liberating. And you know, hope is such a trap in a way, you know. It's a terrible trap. I mean, I've been myself through it, you know. Even though I knew better, it's like a habit. The habit keeps coming up. Even though you know it's unreal, it still come up. It's sometimes it only takes a really difficult, difficult moment in one's life to start listening to the Dhamma, you know, of that experience. And of course, that's when you're very happy to have either a very good teacher or good Dharma friends around you to help you, you know, just to go back to, and the help is not something we don't know already. We know, I mean, we all of us here could easily give a very good talk, I'm sure, in your own way about how to practice. I'm sure every single person in this room will have enough knowledge about the path and how to go about it. At least even one little tool, you know. So it's not like we are lacking knowledge or we are in a state of lack as far as, you know, understanding of what we need to do. We know what to do. But what is often missing is a confidence to stop creating ourselves. And that is the crux of the practice. You know, we can add skillful means after skillful means. We can be as good as, you know, a professor giving lectures on how to practice Buddhism, all the rest of it. But to stop creating delusion through fear, through anxiety, through our inability to stay with a mind that creates maybe hopelessness or through just that tendency to want to hope and just let it be there, to let it be there without any desire to change it or, you know, beat it up, beat it into shape, you know, through Buddhist teaching. Why are you coming back here? You know, hope is completely delusion. Ajahn Sundara said, you know, she gave a talk on the illusion. Hope is an illusion. Hope is, I'm deluded, I'm just hopeful. I used this word not very long ago, in a very difficult situation. Somebody lost hope, and I said, well, I haven't. I'm still hopeful. I feel very happy. I'm hopeful. What it means is that you don't know how things can happen. You don't know how things will manifest. But the heart of the matter is when you stop creating delusion. Can you do that? And to stop creating delusion is not relating to your present delusion in a kind of analytic fashion, you know, by suppressing everything or beating everything into shape so that things look Buddhist, trying to make things as anicca by just kind of repressing things or fearing things, or turning things into a dukkha because you have so much aversion to thinking that you can't bear that thought. So that fits quite well, doesn't it? Aversion, you hate that thought. That's dukkha, yeah, the Buddha said. But that's not, you know, it is dukkha, yes, but have you seen the aversion before the dukkha? You know, have you seen the details of your dukkha? You know, don't label stuff, you know, don't sort of placards label onto your experience. Stay with your experience lovingly and carefully, you know. You know, the Buddhist teaching is about insight into the character, you know, into anicca dukkha anatta, and this insight only arises when you see things as they are. If you want to see a river flowing, you have to sit quietly and look at it, don't you? If you got somebody who is next to you trying to create dams here and push it there and push it back there, have a whole crowd of people trying to sort out things, you know, in a Buddhist way, then you can't never see the river as it is, can you? You constantly, and you imagine all the things you could do on the river, you know. Then you hate bits of the river. Start thinking it should be an island there and should be something else there and should have little inlets and shouldn't have that shape. It's too wide, too narrow. It's flowing too fast. We need to do more dams. Or too slow. We need to kind of stop God from creating the, you know, the heating the universe, heating the planet, and getting all our icebergs melting down, and so on. So, it's not a question of believing that hope is an illusion or hope is not an illusion and so on. That's not the path of practice. The path of practice is to notice what happens when I have a lot of hope about something, a lot of expectation, a lot of waiting for something to happen the way I can only imagine, because you cannot imagine the unknown, can you? Isn't it wonderful that we cannot imagine the unknown? It's all, you know, it's so unknown. It's like, that's what we want when we go to the theater, isn't it? When we go to the magic show, isn't it what we want? The unknown. We don't want to see the same old sketch, do we? We don't want the same old kind of magic and magical play, do we? We want the unknown. We want something new. So why do we sort of, you know, why don't we step on board, you know, of the magic show of our mind, you know, of the magic of life? We have a choice, don't we? And most of the time we miss it, you know. It's a, oh my God, it's trying. Let's have a cup of tea. It's nearly coming, by the way. 5 minutes. You know, we tend to pull back. But life becomes so much more interesting when we start being really in the driver's seat, but not in the I seat, but in the mindfulness seat. You know, when there's nobody there. Mindfulness seat is very nice. There's nobody here. There's nobody controlling anything. But there is such a wealth of energy there. There's such a kind of a wealth of aliveness that makes you investigate things. It's like an investigating energy. It's just there. It's alive. It's like, oh, how exciting. And I mean, you wouldn't say that to everybody, you know, but it's like little kind of feeling in you. Oh, God, isn't it interesting? Oh, is that nun is coming again. Oh, she's problemful. And then suddenly, how interesting. How what happens? You know, when this person comes near me or she starts talking or he starts talking. You start being curious about how you're affected by life. Mm-hmm. And realize that that's all you need to do. I mean, that's, at some point, if you need to respond to a situation, you know, you will. Because, you know, as somebody used to say to me, you know, we feel we're frightened about something, we can't move or something. But if a tiger came into the room, you know, you wouldn't have any problem to move, would you? Would you? And yet we feel we are inadequate a lot of the time. We're inadequate for life often, don't we? We don't feel quite adequate. If we hope we could be different, don't we? There must have been long-term Buddhists in front there. Are they nodding? No. You can see they've been practicing a long time. But, you know, many of us, I mean, we are kind of, it's a mature group, isn't it now, here? I haven't seen a lot of youngsters, you know, sort of zapping around 20 years old, you know, who feel really so miserable about the way they are often. And often they can blame them on their parents who've been telling them all through their childhood, you know, they should be different, better, preferably. Not many parents are mature enough to let their kids be. So the rest of their lives they have to kind of, you know, recover in a monastery. I mean, a recovering stage here. The karma made by our you know, we've made in our youth. And if you're young enough, you might have also your grandparents, you know. Most of the Asian people who come here when they are young, I know the story quite well because I was in Asia for a few years, and you know that the greatest influence in their life hasn't been as much their parents as their grandparents. The grandmother. All the grandmothers have taken those kids to the monastery and they just can't stand monasteries anymore. Buddhism, anything. They will do anything but not Buddhism, you know. Because granny... I mean, you have also the case where they really have this devotional approach, you know, from their grandmother. So it's both ways. It works both ways. So, I hope that this has given you a little bit of... you know, a little bit of material to continue this investigation about hope. And it's a lovely topic because it is a quality of the mind that is highly, highly elevated in the Christian tradition. And even though here we have people who are Asian and Buddhist by birth, but most British people would have been brought up as either Anglican or Catholic, you know. And so even me, who never been brought up as a Christian, I remember, you know, being quite reactive at some point about why is this word hope, you know, not really made more of. Because if you're not careful and you attach to the concept of suffering, knowingly or unknowingly, you can start getting yourself depressed with it. You know, life is just suffering, but you forget, you know, because we don't realize often enough the freedom from suffering, which is a second message given by the Buddha. I teach you suffering and the end of suffering, you know. So we forget the second part, but the more you realize the second part of the freedom of suffering, then the less suffering has an impact on you, you know. But if you haven't yet sort of realized the blessing and the joy of not being free of, you know, at least to a certain degree of suffering, then you can say, oh, you know, you can actually, your consciousness can start getting colored, you know, by this concept. You know, it's all suffering. People are suffering. There's a bag of bones, you know, pus and snot and bones and... you know, the 24 parts of the body that we recite in our reflection in the morning. And, you know, what's called the reflection of the unattractive part of the body. So, you know, the Buddha encouraged if you fall in love with somebody, just make sure, you know, notice the outside, yes, but the inside is also this and this and that. Kind of cools you down, doesn't it? The hope level just goes down instantly, doesn't it? The illusion, maybe not the illusion of hope, but the illusion of that person, your expectation just goes down a bit, you know. So a bit more, it's not like you have finished with your possible relationship with somebody, but at least you come to a more kind of cool ground, you know. It's like wisdom, compassion can carry on functioning properly. Not attachment, greed, passion, and, you know, stupidity. So these concepts like loving kindness, kindness, metta, hope, you know, use them, aspiration, you know, do you feel the teaching just asks, you know, it's a sort of is a way of, it's like a field of investigation for our life as it is, not as, you know, as a concept, as an idea, as an ideal, you know. But even an ideal, you can play around with an ideal. It's not that you have not be an idealistic person, but just we learn what happens when I idealize somebody or idealize a situation, and it happens not to be the way I thought it would be or I hoped it would be. What happened to me? We just know. And the more you learn, this is your teacher. You are teaching yourself how to relate to life so that it becomes a joyful relationship, a live, joyful, liberating relationship. And I'm not saying it's easy. It is easy. Don't think I've got any of the answer myself, I'm just very happy to be a Buddhist nun right now and relating to the past in the way I do. But it's, it's tricky. It's not easy. So now I think it's time for a cup of tea. Thank you for listening.